live from the Carter Subaru Studio. You are listening to hour number 3 of the Jason Rand Show on this Monday night. Thank you so much for tuning in tonight. If you want to join the conversation at any point, something we say gets some kind of reaction that you just have to share with us, send us a text at 98973. You can also email me at mynorthwest.com/JasonRant. We still have a lot to get to tonight, including the third wave of coffee in Seattle. The first wave was like the Folgers crystal stuff. The second wave was espresso. The third wave, you're going to love it if you love coffee. If you don't like coffee, I'll try to make it interesting for you. Because that's all I can do. Before we get to that, Sound Transit is owning up to a mistake. Wink, wink. Sound Transit, mistakenly, they say, released 173,000 email addresses to a campaign that would then use said email addresses to send material to pushing for ST3, which would give $54 billion to Sound Transit. Oops. Usually, mistakes end up hurting the organization that makes the mistake. Somehow, in this case, the mistake was actually beneficial to them. Now, of course, Sound Transit admits the mistake on Friday of last week, which is generally what you do when you want to admit to something or release data that you don't necessarily want to release. You do it on a Friday because you think it's going to get lost in the shuffle. You get in the way of an extended news cycle. Seattle Times reports the distribution of the transit pass holder's email address was a mistake made as part of Sound Transit's response to the Mass Transit Now campaign's recent public disclosure request for the transit agency's email subscribers list, Sound Transit spokesperson Jeff Patrick said.
It turns out our response to the campaign was more broadly construed than it should have been.
That's how he sounds in my head. I don't know how he sounds. Now, it might have been illegal, because apparently you have special protections as an Orca Card member to not have this information get sent out. Now, I don't know if I was affected. Apparently anyone after 2011 who has an Orca Card and gave them your email address, which I think you have to, was impacted by this. I think they said they're going to send out an email if they haven't already to the people who were impacted. I pray, because I have an Orca Card. I pray tonight when I get home, when I leave this studio at 9:56 and 35 seconds, I get home, I lay in bed, brush my teeth, shampooed my hair, shampooed again because I got extra stuff in it today, and then condition it, wash my face, get into my nice little pajamas, which are really just my boxers. Turn on the fan because it's been a little unusually hot in my apartment. I tell my Amazon Now to turn my lights off. Then right before I close my eyes, I'm going to take a moment, just a moment, to speak directly to God and ask him, please, 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 oh, please, let it be known that my email address was given away so I can sue, because I'm a sue. I will join the lawsuit. I will lead the lawsuit because I don't like this. Because something about this seems awfully fishy to me. Something about a mistake that actually helps get funding for the organization, for the agency that made said mistake. Something about that doesn't quite smell right to me. Now, I don't remember getting the email, but I delete a lot of stuff. Hi, friend. You love riding transit. Let everyone know how much you want this to happen. Hi, friend. You can't even come up with the service that automatically populates my name. Hi, friend. When was the last time you said to an actual friend, hey, friend? Hey, friendo. What's going on, friend? No, my name's Jason. We've met before. You know, we hung out. I'm not friend. It's like saying, hey, guy, to just some random guy. Hey, guy, what's going on? You mean you forgot my name? Guess we weren't friends, were we? I don't think this was done in error. Now, I think they might use the whole idea of we were just being cooperative with the requests with the Freedom of Information request, the documents request. We were just going out of our way to make sure we give you everything you need. Because one of two things happens. I'm someone who puts in a lot of these requests to different organizations, sometimes because I just want to be a pain in their arm. But usually it's because I'm trying to find a story, because I've gotten a tip, because the agency that I'm dealing with has decided to not answer me directly, and I always have that in the back pocket. Okay, I'll put in a public disclosure request. Now, one of two things happens. They either don't give you all the information, you have no idea because there's no way to find out. You're just trusting them. Or two, they'll give you so much knowing that you're not going to be able to go through tens of thousands of pages worth of documents that you're just completely buried and overwhelmed and you move on. So I suppose it is possible that Sound Transit responding to a public documents request from the campaign that is in favor of Sound Transit decided to just inundate them with so much stuff they would never actually be able to effectively engage in that campaign for which they would benefit. I suppose that's possible. Or maybe they know that they could use that as an excuse. Now, I don't know. I suppose we can take them at their word. But they are also the people who say that they've been on time and under budget with ST1, which it turns out is not true. So I don't know if I believe this. Jacob, why don't you tell me to read the next paragraph of the Seattle Times story?
Why didn't I?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Sound Transit's improper sharing of ORCA cardholder information marks the second time in 5 months that the agency likely violated state law related to the ST3 ballot measure. This is the second time! I guess they're awfully giving with the information. They're really helpful to the agency that is, or to the campaign that's pushing for the agency. Really? Do you believe this? I don't think I believe it. I just don't. I don't. I'd love to hear from you. Send us a text, 98973. Don't worry, not you, Producer Jacob. I know you got scared. I was putting you on the spot.
Yeah.
I was talking to the audience. Speaking of Sound Transit, we just found out the numbers behind something we kind of already knew. But validation sometimes is really awesome. Getting that validation. Mike Lindblom over at the Seattle Times confirmed what, frankly, Dory's been blasting for what seems like a decade. The Sound Transit One package, it was never on time. It was never on budget, no matter what they say. Sound Transit's cost for its corridor, the first quarter, SeaTac to the U District, Seattle Times says, will wind up 86% higher than the 1996 initial estimates. So in 1996, what was the promise by Sound Transit? They said, listen, you give us $1.6 billion, what we're going to build in 10 years, by 2006, we're going to get you light rail between the University of Washington and SeaTac Airport. We're going to get you seamlessly connected via light rail. It's only going to take 10 years, $1.67 billion. It's not done yet. It's what's today's date? What year? Because sometimes I get lost.
2016.
2016? 2016?
Correct.
Let me do the math. Hold on. I'm not very good at math. Carry the one to plus, divide it by two, times a quarter. I don't know how to do 20%. I don't know how to do percent. Wait, hold on. I'm using my app. Oh, it turns out, yeah. So it's 20 years overdue? It's 10 years overdue than what it was? Okay, got it. So it's not done? In March, we got 10 years late. We got part of that UW track. Oh, you've got to still another mile to go, and you're not okay. Got it. And yet, we've known this for a while now. Sound Transit still says they're on time. Sound Transit still says this particular project was on budget, under budget even. They touted that in their press release. Then they had the audacity, to go on the Dory Monson show, to go on there and dare to say that they're on time and under budget. That's only true if you completely ignore the first 10 years of them squandering our tax dollars.
I have the SoundMove documents in front of me from 1996. SoundMove includes a light rail line between the U District, Capitol Hill, First Hill, on and on, during the SoundMove 10-year implementation period. That's what you guys sold to the voters. And you said everybody knows that you guys did a reset a decade ago. I don't think everybody around. We've had a lot of people who are transplants. And if they hear on time and under budget, they might think that you're actually on time and under budget, but you're actually 10 years behind what you sold to the voters. So how can you guys claim that you're on time and under budget?
Well, you know, going back to what I just said, when we, you know, we put the project on ice, it was uncertain what we were going to be able to do.
Uncertain.
The new administration set out transit in 2008 said, here's what's achievable. Okay. We can do this project and finish it in 2016 and within a certain amount of money, and we're doing it ahead of that schedule and under budget. So as far as we're concerned, we're, you know, doing better than we promised back then. You're going back a lot of years, 15 years.
I'm going back 20 years to when you, 21 years when you sold this to the voters.
Can you believe that? Can you believe that? This is like going, hey guy, contractor man, can you do my kitchen? Yes, we'll get it done in 6 months. It'll cost you $10,000. Awesome. I can do that. Now, it's going to be a little bit of a pain to be without a kitchen for 6 months. And $10,000, that's a lot of money. But it's going to triple the resale value of my home once I decide to sell. 14 years later, he comes back and says, hey, we reset. We reset 14 years. Ignore all that. If you ignore all of that, we got 6 months. We got it done, man. Yeah, I know we spent $3.7 billion during all this. The most expensive kid. I'll be honest. We didn't know what we were doing. When I agreed to do this, when I agreed to take this on, I didn't quite understand plumbing. But I learned along the way. It took me 14 years. But the last 6 months, I got it done. What? Really? Really, man? It was. And what bothers me about this line of thinking, it's a needless lie. There's no reason to say anything other than, look, yeah, we were wrong. But once we got our stuff together, it took us 10 years. And that was what we were wrong. But we figured it out. In fact, look what we're doing now with Sound Transit 2. Okay, don't look too closely because we didn't get to the bulk of the actual thing. But I mean, look what we're doing. Why lie? Why just say, yeah, we got done in 10 years if you ignore the first 10 years? In what world does that work? I'm Jason Rantz. Welcome back to the Jason Rand Show. Much like talk show hosts and entertainers in general, dogs simply want praise. In fact, according to another study, they prefer praise over treats. Again, just like me. I was in the boss's office earlier in the day. I was desperate for some kind of attention. How did I do last week? Did you listen? Did you like it? Can you give me some feedback? You know what he did? He tossed me a Werther's Original. I angrily ate it.
And it wasn't a chewy one. It was.
It wasn't. It was hard. I had to suck on it. I was there for 11 minutes just crying. And you know what he did? As I was just waiting for some feedback, he sat there and smiled. He kept throwing candy at me. Such a jerk. I'm kidding. It wasn't a Werther's. It was a Tootsie Roll. Emery, it was very good.
I don't like to. Werther's is better.
Okay, Grandpa.
Anyway, just wanted to throw my candy opinion in there for some reason.
Oh, the world is a better place for that. Emory University did a study with 15 dogs, and they had their brains scanned as they were shown different objects that these dogs were trained to associate with rewards. So according to Mother Nature Network, they wrote, the dogs had already learned that when they saw a toy car, for example, they would be given a piece of a hot dog. When they saw a toy horse, their owner would pop in for a few effusive moments of good dog praise. When they saw a hairbrush, nothing happened. They might have been scared because you probably hit the dog with the hairbrush. Don't do that. So they did these brain scans as they showed them all of these images. The brain scans, what?
Sorry, for you, you said that you, that this is all accurate for you, or it's like similar to you and dogs, but the hairbrush, that would get
quite
you excited.
I'm just so excited. Like, oh my God, I have 14 of those at home.
You'd be the most excited about that.
I'd be so excited. Don't give me praise or a treat. Give me a hairbrush, man. Give me a fine tooth comb. Thanks for interrupting my flow.
Yeah,
this is what the brain scan showed. 9 of the dogs had the exact same excitement level when they saw a treat versus when they saw something that evoked a good dog praise, owner being happy. 4 had more excitement for the praise than the treats. So you've got 9 who treated it equally, and then you had 4 who loved the praise more than the treats. That's interesting to me because you always think, oh, here the dog doesn't care about the praise. No, it cares. So then they put these poor dogs in a maze. On one end of the maze, it was food. It was treats. On the other part, it was the owner. He's saying, good dog. Good little guy. Almost every single dog, all but 2 of the 15, went to the owner for the praise rather than for the treats. So why is this important? According to the website, researchers have said the study findings might help owners train their pets and might also identify dogs suited for work as service dogs. A dog that prefers praise, for example, might make a good therapy dog, while a dog that prefers treats might be better suited for a job that's more independent from humans, like a search and rescue dog. And in that case, the treat is marijuana and other illicit drugs. I think if you go to people, this is also mostly true because you've seen cases where people will take praise instead, at least according to the study. They just want to hear that they're doing a good job rather than just get an automatic raise. Personally, I would prefer both. But if I had to choose, probably the money. But I mean, I want both. I'd be the 9 dogs that equally treated both the money and the praise. I'm Jason Rantz. Welcome back to the Jason Rantz Show. I love me some coffee, man. I drink coffee all day. I wake up and I am very specific. I get out my coffee beans. We'll get into what I drink in a bit. I take out my hand grinder. I grind the coffee beans coarsely. And then I have a nice pour over. Every single morning, that's how I start my day. I feel weird when I don't start my day that way. And I'm going and I'm drinking coffee, whether it's cold brew or flat whites. I'm doing that all day. I am addicted. The good news is, for me, this trend of taking coffee seriously, more seriously, more seriously, more seriously than the previous generations shows absolutely no signs of stopping. Car Radio's Josh Kearns had the opportunity to look into what's being called the third wave of coffee. In other words, the next evolution, the first wave was the mass-produced crap like Folgers, the instant coffee, which I don't quite understand. Is it actual coffee? I can't do that with my coffee beans. What is it? The second wave of coffee was apparently espresso's popularity, in this country at least, that gave rise to stores like Starbucks. And now the third wave of coffee, the experts are arguing, is treating coffee as a true art and craft. Sort of like the way we treat wine or beer.
Every aspect of making coffee, we really want to understand and practice how all the variables mesh together to make a great cup of coffee.
That is Jill Killen. She owns 3 coffee shops in Seattle, Cloud City, El Diablo, and Royal Drummer. And she says, if you really want to take this seriously, really want to understand the third wave, the next evolution of coffee, it all starts with understanding the beans.
In this particular bag right in front of us from Camber, it has a Catura, a Tipica, a Variedad Colombia, Inza, and Cauca. So there's 5 different varieties of coffee in this one bag.
You judge the coffee on where it's grown, the elevation of where it's grown, the type of soil it's growing in. Frankly, all things that we pretend impacts the taste when, if we're being honest, most of you, including myself, when we sip the coffee, we're not able to tell the difference beyond some of the basics. At least I can, and I consider myself to be a little bit of a coffee snob. For me, it's all about the grind. Unfortunately, too many of you, you dopes, you're buying the coffee that's pre-ground. What are you doing? That is a sin against nature. You grind it yourself. It's fresher. When you grind it yourself, it gets stale quicker. when you get a pregame. Guys, what are you doing, man? That's why I grind it myself. I'm a fan of, I like to drink local coffee roasters, or at least like to shop there. Have you ever heard of Beanbox?
So no.
Beanbox.co. I wish they were a sponsor. They're not a sponsor. They should be, by the way. It's a subscription service that sends you, you can do either two types of things. You get, I think it's four small bags of sample coffee from four different roasters, or you get one coffee of the month. I just switched over to the coffee of the month. It's $20 a month for a big old bag of coffee, beans. You grind it yourself, and it's $20. The sample one was $17, I think, if you do it over a six-month period. And they just send you stuff. And they were sending me a whole bunch of stuff every month, and I'm testing out everything. Velton's coffee out of Everett is so good. And so I want to give them a shout-out, Velton's coffee out of Everett, and also a shout-out to beanbox.co, because I never would have found out of Velton's coffee, V-E-L-T-O-N-S, apostrophe S, Velton's coffee. I would have never found them without Beanbox. I love that stuff. They are so good. And when you start to get into it and start to understand some of the intricacies into how coffee is supposed to taste and how hot the water is supposed to be and for how long it's supposed to be brewing, what kind of water you actually should use, all of a sudden, a cup of coffee that otherwise would be nothing spectacular, all of a sudden, that gets so much more complex, so much more wonderful.
And so it's super important that you don't use water right out of the tap, because it has chlorine in it and fluoride, and you want to get that stuff out. Unfortunately, water in Seattle doesn't have as many minerals as water in other places, and so our holy grail is to try to create the perfect water in the shop to make the coffee taste better.
Just use a Brita. If you use a Brita, whatever their
filter,
it's their filter, but I can't remember. It's like a charcoal filter, whatever. Use their Brita filter, and you should be taking it. That's how I do it. I brew my water after I take it from the Brita container, and I put it into my Keurig, which I just use to make it hot, and then I do the pour over.
It sounds like they're not trying to get filter stuff out. They're trying to get minerals in it that aren't there.
Well, you want to get some of the stuff out. You want to get some of the crap out. So you get that stuff out. Now, I suppose I can buy bottled mineral water. I'm not doing that.
That's where you draw the line.
What are you, nuts? I've got my thing all down to an art. I'm not going to go now half to the Whole Foods and buy extra water. And, of course, the method actually matters, because you can brew coffee in a whole bunch of ways. You can do, of course, the espresso machines. You can do the cold brew, which I've done at home, which I make especially potent. And, of course, you can do the pour over. You can do the press pot.
If you don't like a lot of acidity in your coffee, cold brew is a great option for you. If you like a coffee and you want to taste all the flavors in a single origin bean, we might talk about pour over. If you're going to put your coffee in milk of some sort, then, you know, absolutely, let's get you a coffee roasted properly for espresso.
And so how do you know which method is best for you? Because you haven't tried all. Be honest, man. Be honest, lady listening to me right now in Linwood. Be honest, guy, friend, listening to me in Everett, you haven't tried them all. Places like Royal Drummer in Ballard, they encourage you to try all of them. And she says, look, don't be intimidated.
I think there's a perception out there that baristas are very stuck up and,
well, some of them
and look down on customers.
Sometimes they do.
And we fight really hard against that, because we want people to come in and feel comfortable ordering and not feel self-conscious. And I see it all the time. People say, I just messed that up. There's got to be a better way to say that. And I'm like, however you said it, it's fine. Like, it is not my job to judge how you order. It's my job to make what you want.
Unless you go to the best coffee shop in London, where I got scolded once. I totally got scolded once because I asked for cream. They got mad, man. They got really mad. Every once in a while, when I'm trying a new type of coffee, if I'm concerned it's going to be a little bit too bitter because I haven't tasted it before, I like to have just a splash of heavy cream. That's usually how I drink my coffee. Now, in the mornings, it's totally black. I use half of a Splenda just to sweeten things up a little bit. But it's always black. I just got a tweet from Mitra. I almost always take my coffee black when I do the pour over with just a half of a Splenda. But I asked them for that, and they said, you should get an Americano. I said, I don't want an Americano. I want to try this. He goes, well, you can't use cream in it. They told me I can't do it. And I said, okay, I won't do it. I'll just try it black. Fine. You promise? She said, you promise? I go, yeah, I'm not going to. You have to give me the cream. There's no cream out here. I can't do it. And she looked at me as she's taking it. I swear to you, she was looking at me like looking up at me as she's looking down to do the cash. She's got one eye up and like, I'm looking at you. I'm judging you. And then as I got the coffee, I swear to you, she was staring at me and made me walk to my table just by staring at me, knowing that I couldn't go and even put a sweetener in it. It was a good, great cup of coffee. She was right.
It would be great if you had like some creamer in your pocket and you got to your table and you pulled it out and just like poured it in.
Well, just like did it on like looking around, sneaking out a flask. You think there's whiskey or something and it's heavy cream. It's half and half. One great thing they say is to try is called a shot in the dark or red eye espresso and brewed coffee together, which I've never had, or serve side by side.
It's like a relationship. I get to spend some time with that coffee and taste it two different ways. I love a great Ethiopian bean that has, you know, fruit and floral notes, some good acidity.
And because Josh Kearns can't just be happy that there's the third wave that's happening right now, he's like, well, what's the fourth wave? Oh, aren't you curious, Josh?
I think fourth wave will be science and getting really into digging into the science of water, into the science of what grinding
H2O.
Looks like, keeping coffee sustainable. And it's probably going to mean, honestly, more automation, which a lot of baristas are scared about.
Yeah, well, that's the future of poor baristas. That's the future of the labor market. I am obsessed with this stuff. I tried to geek out on wine. I tried to become like a wine connoisseur. The problem was I was getting drunk very quickly and tired even more quickly. And so it doesn't quite – you can't study it if you're falling asleep after one glass of wine.
You're not supposed to drink it. You're supposed to sip it and then
disgusting.
Spit it out.
I'm not brushing my teeth and gargling with wine. It's disgusting. No. By the way, the first affogato bar in Washington just opened in Kirkland. Speaking of coffee, it's Serena's Gelato, which I'm pretty sure they follow me on the Twitter, so I like them. So an affogato is what sounds like – avocado, but it's Italian, and it's spelled A-F-F-O-G-A-T-O. It's espresso poured over gelato, which sounds so amazing. I want some, please. Here are the flavors they have. Amaretto di Saronia. I know the amaretto part. Isn't that just almond, basically? Kind of like a sweet almond. Whiskey cream. Grande chocolate. Vanilla from the Isle of Bourbon. And Mediterranean hazelnut. Not exactly sure how their hazelnuts are different in the Mediterranean. Maybe a Mediterranean. I always thought a Mediterranean hazelnut was actually just an olive. Doesn't that sound good? An affogato?
Yeah, it sounds like a very. It's like I like milkshakes a lot, and this just sounds like a classy version of those.
It's like an adult version of a milkshake.
Right.
Maybe if you took your date to the affogato bar instead of that creamery that you went to.
Maybe I would have gotten a second date out of the deal.
Maybe she'd return your text. Should have taken her to Serena's Gelato in Kirkland.
Well, I can always ask her out again.
Here for the 14th time, so she'll ignore you, and then you're definitely not getting into stalker status. It's the Jason Rand Show.